Hello, I'm Valerie Jackson. This evening, Lois Reitzes will be sitting in for me in another engaging interview on Between the Lines. So, stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Lois Reitzes in for Valerie Jackson this week. Today, I'll be going between the lines with Holocaust survivor Tosha Schneider. She'll talk about her memoir, Someone Must Survive to Tell the World. Tosha Schneider, welcome.
Thank you.
For many survivors of the Nazi Holocaust, it was difficult, if not impossible, to talk about their World War II experiences. And given those experiences, I think whatever enabled people to get through life without talking about it, they should be allowed that. What prompted you to write this memoir?
First, I would like to refer to the fact that people didn't talk about it. I came to my cousin in Peekskill, New York, who was a lovely and caring person. And the one thing she said to me right away is, forget the past and start a new life. This was the mantra. Don't talk about it. Don't refer to it. It's a new beginning. It's a new life. And there was such a euphoria after the Second World War here. People wanted to forget about the war. They just wanted to go on with their lives. And we were struggling to get a foothold in a new country, new language, and so forth. So it was many, many years, and I always knew. Somebody asked me recently how long it took me to write this. And I said, 63 years from the day I was liberated, I knew I was going to do it. I knew that I had to fulfill that pledge that I made to my mother to tell the world, should I survive? It took me a long time, but I'm glad I've done it.
Did you want to speak about your experiences? Did that help you? I know in the book you said there were no psychologists or psychiatrists around when you were being rescued and when your papers were getting in order to emigrate. Did you even want to express in words what had happened?
In some ways, yes, because I felt I needed to tell somebody. I needed for people to understand what really occurred. And yet there were such different responses to it. Some people, as I said, very well-meaning people said, forget about it, start a new life. Don't speak about it. And then life takes over. You know, I was married, had three children, was busy, was working. And the older I got, I realized that there is something I have not done. I have not fulfilled that pledge. And I said it has to be done.
Your memoir begins with you speaking very affectionately about the town where you were born and then where your parents moved a little bit later. Mm-hmm. It seemed that your early childhood, you were educated enough to have spoken Polish in the home. You didn't speak Yiddish.
No, I think this is a misconception. Majority of the people in already in the 30s where I was, when my mother was a teacher in a Polish public school, the language at home was Polish. But, of course, German was something they were very familiar to because the First World War. Before that, there was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and their language was German. Because when I look back at it, somebody told me, it seems like it was idyllic. In some way, yes. We were very close-knit family. The little town of Zaleszczyki was a little resort place, and it was just beautiful. And then we moved to my mother's hometown of Horodenko, and there was her whole family, cousins, uncle, grandmother. My grandfather passed away before that. So, yes, there was always this undertone of anti-Semitism, especially in the late 30s. My parents were always concerned about my brother not being able to study, get higher education, and all that sort of thing. But basically, it was a good life before the war.
Education was first and foremost in your home, as in so many Jewish
always.
Homes.
This is one of the things that was such a disparity. No matter how poor a Jewish household was, children were schooled. You couldn't find a Jewish child being illiterate in Hebrew and Yiddish, whatever it was, but they could read and write. You went out to the villages around us. 90% of the peasants were illiterate. The priests could speak, could read, maybe a few rich peasants, but basically we lived among people who were illiterate. As I mentioned in my book, we used to attend every afternoon Hebrew school for 2 hours. And I always joke with my Sunday school kids that this was not a cruel, unusual punishment. But there we were imbued with such understanding and love for our culture, for our faith, that when the Nazis came, it made us feel as though we were inhuman, as though we were totally worthless. They had the power, but we didn't believe it. We knew that they were the scum of the earth, not the other way around.
How old were you when the doom descended?
When the war started, I was 11, 1939. I recall being on vacation with my family, and I got a telegram from my father to return home. And as we got to the railroad station, there was already troops moving to the German border, and war was imminent. What we did not know, that at the same time, German army troops were moving east, and they had slogans on their cars, "We are off to Poland to thrash the Jews." Hundreds of miles from my little town of Hrodenka, they were setting plans to annihilate everything we loved and cherished. But the first war started on September 1st, 1939. Our city was bombed. There were some civilian casualties. And within 17 days, Poland surrendered. And our area was occupied by the Soviet Army.
Your father detested the communist regime.
He did.
And this impacted subsequent events, didn't it?
Well, we were always worried that he'll be exiled. He obviously detested the communist regime. But the people that they primarily exiled, and there were some 1,200 from our town, were religious leaders, political leaders, Zionists, both Jews and Gentiles, very wealthy landowners. We were not in that category. But talking too much could have endangered his life as well. I mean, he could have sent him to Siberia. Looking back, I wish they had. I wish they had. He had a chance to survive.
He was an accountant?
Yes.
And this helped him, I guess, helped your family last a little bit longer.
Yes, as long as we were in our hometown, as long as we were there, and the Germans could not find Aryan to substitute for him, so they kept him. It was just an accountant. He really ran the mill. So we had flour. He could bring some flour home. And when we were in our own backyard, we did not starve. It was when we were expelled from our town, when our town became Judenrein, that starvation was
Judenrein, free of
free
Jews.
Free of Jews, yes.
What year, then, was that, 41?
In June 1941, the Germans attacked the Soviet Union. And the first troop were Hungarians. They were the allies, of course, of Germany. There were some disgraceful things, beating up people and so forth, but nothing really terrible has happened yet. In July, the Germans came in, and that's where the reign of terror began. Every day there were new orders issued, each one under penalty of death if not followed. All Jewish men from the ages of 14 to 60 must register for slave labor. All Jews must wear the white armband with the Star of David. And I always tell my kids that they miscalculated the Nazis in this respect. This was a passport to death, but it was never a badge of shame for us. We loved that symbol, and today it graces the flag of the first Jewish state in 2,000 years, Israel. Jewish children could not go to school. And again, we lived next door to my Polish public school, and I ran to my mother and I said, why can't I go? I was a pretty good student. I was a well-behaved kid. And I'll never forget the pain in her eyes. She could not explain. Not only could her children not go to school, but she's a teacher. Could not teach, could not do what she loved best.
So she took it upon herself to teach you and some friends.
And a few of my friends. And this was, again, to teach Jewish children who was under the threat of death, because everything was under the threat of death there. Again, there were times that I wondered. She taught us history and poetry and language. And there were times I wondered why she didn't teach us how to make Molotov cocktails. Mm-hmm. But as years passed, I realized how wise she was. She wanted us to believe that there is a future for us, that there is hope for us. Of course, one by one, my little friends disappeared. Really a silly euphemism. They were murdered.
Is it possible for you to talk about the subsequent fate of your parents and your brother?
Sure. In October of 1941, a ghetto was established in our town. We had to move to my grandmother's house. I recall picking up my little kitten, and mother said, you can't take her. And I said, why not? And she said, there won't be enough food in the ghetto. And I was so shocked, you know, not enough food in the ghetto. Of course, before long, we realized how true it was. So in December of 1941, an order was issued that all Jews must assemble in front of the Great Synagogue to be inoculated against typhus. And many of our people were skeptical. Why would the Nazis suddenly worry about our health? My father hid us in the mill where he worked. We sat there freezing in the attic of that mill and heard shots and screams all around us. You know, you the Rouse, you know, Jews out. When we returned back to the ghetto, the whole family was assembled at my grandmother's house. Three of my cousins were crying. My uncle was desolate. Turned out that my aunt, my tall, beautiful redhead Aunt Mincha, was taken away. She was the first in our family. My grandmother, who was an ailing, sickly woman, was a pillar of strength at that time. She tried to reassure us and tell us that we will try to find out where these people were taken, and we will bring her food, send her food and warm clothes. Maybe we could even buy her freedom. We went to sleep somewhat reassured, only to wake up the next morning and find out about the catastrophe that descended on our town. Half of the Jewish population, 2,500 men, women, and children, were driven to a nearby forest of Shemakovtse. They were forced to disrobe in a barn, and a group of five approached the ravine where they were machine gunned. The following day, the SS Commander Doppler came to the UNRWA, Jewish Community Center, and he demanded 2,500 marks for the bullet span killing the Jews. Public mourning was forbidden. Any Jewish man found unshaved, it is our custom of the 7 day of mourning, was severely beaten. So my aunt, Mincha, was the first one. Then the second axia occurred.
Axia,
the roundup, right? Sometime in Passover, I think it was April 12th. And one more time, our father hit us in the mill. And again, the dogs and the screams all around us, people who were rounded up. At this point, they were brought to the railroad station. And I recall shivering in that attic of the mill. And hearing this plaintive whistle, and I didn't know that on the train bound for Belzec's extermination camp was my dearest childhood friend, mm-hmm. Genya Reif. Her mother was a very fine musician, by the way, a violinist. She always insisted that someday she would be a great singer in America. In New York, no less, she was 12 years old. On that train bound for Belzec was my Uncle Nathan, my uncle Nathan, his son Max, cousin Visha. The third axia occurred in September. Once again, the people were brought to the railroad station and packed into cattle cars.
Is this 41 or 42?
That was already 42, September of 42. And at that point, our city was declared Judenfrei for you Jews, and everybody had to leave within 24 hours.
And you were still hiding in your father's mill?
No, just for those few days of the Aktion. So we all assembled in my grandmother's house, the whole family. And the family decided that my ailing grandmother could just never survive the horror of going yet to another ghetto. And they thought that maybe putting her to sleep with a lethal injection would be a merciful thing to do. We sat all in the living room as he entered her bedroom, tears running down our faces. And after a few minutes, he came out apologizing and crying, said he couldn't do it. Mm. And not even then could he become a mercy killer. But what he did for us all, he gave us each a poison pill. And we had to promise that we'll only use it in extreme conditions.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Tosha Schneider, a Holocaust survivor. She's discussing her memoir, Someone Must Survive to Tell the World.
My father was allowed to remain in the city because he was the so-called Wertvoller Jude. They needed him for work. But he could not keep us with them. Only about 70 people remained in all of the town.
70?
70 out of a population of 5,000 before the war. One day I called there and spoke to the secretary on the phone, and she told me that the Gestapo came there the day before. Wanted to take him, and his boss said that the books were not in order. He needed him. So they said, all right, we'll wait 24 hours.
So they could make use.
Right. And then they took him away. And to this day, I'm not quite sure, except a few weeks ago, I was Googling, and I found out that the last of the 70 people of my hometown were brought to a forest of Sheparovtsy outside of Kulmy, and they were murdered there. So I assumed that that is what happened to my father. And then my mother, my brother, and I had a brother 2 years older, Yulek, wound up in the ghetto of Tulsa. If there ever was a hellhole on earth, this was it. A few narrow streets crowded with thousands of people that they brought from the remaining villages and towns with terrible starvation and typhus. And I think that winter, my mother made an attempt to save my life. She met a man who had taken my cousin on false papers to the Ukraine. And when he saw me, he said, well, she doesn't look Jewish, whatever that means, quote unquote. I had long, blonde pigtails at the time. Said, get her ready in 2 days, and I will take her with me to a remote village and tell them, my friend, that she's my cousin. My mother was overjoyed. You know, somebody had a chance of survival. So for the next 2 days, she was teaching me how to behave in church. She was teaching me about the catechism. And things she knew because, as a teacher, she was in class when the priest came to instruct the kids. And every time my resolve waned, she kept repeating over and over, someone must survive to tell the world. Someone must survive. And so I got ready the second day. It was winter time, very cold, deep snow. I said goodbye to my brother, and we walked to the edge of the ghetto. I took my armband off and embraced my mother. And suddenly it became very clear to me that I obviously never see her again. And I said, and my naivete, I was only 14. I saw there will be no Jews surviving. I'll be the only one. And why would I want to live in a world where our people are murdered so brutally? And among the people who have not actively participated, certainly stood idly by. And I told her I'm not leaving. And I'm forever grateful that she didn't urge me. She realized it, even though I was only 14, it had to be my decision. And so I had a few more precious weeks with her. That winter, she got typhus, and at the age of 39, her heart gave up.
And your brother finally succumbed as well.
Well, my brother and I wound up in a labor camp of Lisovce. We worked in the field, and while the work was difficult, we didn't starve as badly as we did in the ghetto. First of all, the food was better. They gave us soup and bread at noontime and in the evening. And then in an open field, I could always find something edible. And the commander of our camp, named Frank, was a pretty decent man. As a matter of fact, I'm trying lately to find out. I only know his last name, and I only know that he was from Berlin. But I think he was one of the righteous of the nations. He prevented the execution of all of us, as I will tell you in a little bit. But my brother and I were taken to that camp and work in the fields. And one time, my brother's unit worked the night shift. We worked at the threshing machine around the clock. And my brother's group worked the night shift, and I was sleeping in a haystack with a woman who was hiding two children among the workers, a little boy of 4 and a girl of 6, when suddenly, before dawn, it was still dark, shots were heard all around us, and there was two Ukrainian policemen in assessment. One shot hit the little girl in the foot. The child was crying and whimpering, and we were told to go to the assembly point. When we got there, there were a number of people already sitting. The men were ordered to dig graves. And I remember being perfectly calm. I thought to myself, if our sages and our rabbis were right, and there is an Olam Haba, a world beyond, then all will be well. I will be with my family, with my friends. And if it's only this world of horror to be done with, it will be okay as well.
You were ready to accept that.
Absolutely. I had enough. But suddenly the commander of our camp came running on a horse and screaming at the Gestapo that he needed us to complete the harvest. They can come after the harvest and kill us all. There was a lot of yelling back and forth, and they left. And we proceeded to collect our fallen comrades, and among them was my brother Yurek, 17. The days were followed, were hard.
When your camp was liberated, it was by the Russians.
Yes, yes.
And did you believe that this was over? How does one trust anyone in a situation when one's been through what you have?
Well, at the time, you really don't think in these terms. It's just simply a question of survival, to get a piece of bread to survive the day, to see to it that they are not in front of an assessment who's ready to kill you. And the last days before, we heard already the Katyushas from afar, you know, the Russian big guns. And we saw trains with German wounded going day after day through the railroad stations. We heard that Stalingrad had fallen. We had heard that the Soviets are moving closer to us. But our captors were telling us, well, you might be hearing the Katyushas, but we will kill you before they ever come here. So the last days of the German occupation there, they used us to, at the railroad station, to just load anything they could get their hands on, wheat and live pigs, and to take to Germany. The cars were moving very slowly as we were working there. What they couldn't take, they poured gasoline and burned.
Didn't want to share it with.
Didn't want anybody to have it. And then quite unexpectedly, Russian tanks appeared. There was the 27th of March. People were overjoyed, you know, tried to kiss the hands of the soldiers there. The soldiers were stunned. They said they have traveled for hundreds of miles through all of the Ukraine, and they never found Jews any place. How did we survive? And for a moment there, some of them wondered, were you collaborators? Mm. Which was obviously total nonsense. They were very kind. They tried to help us. But it was like half an hour after that joyous moment, some 8 German Stuka planes flew over the camp, over the barracks, through incendiary bombs. Mm. The barracks burned. They were wooden. If people tried to escape, they were machine gunned from the air. And I always tell the story of one woman. We used to call her our Nightingale. She had a beautiful voice. And when I entered one of the barracks, she was severely wounded, and I tried to reassure her that we will take her to the Russian field hospital and find help for her. And all she said, hold my hand a little longer. It's too late for me. And indeed it was.
I was privileged many years ago to sit in on a very small seminar with Elie Wiesel. And he was reading us, talking about a story of some Hasidim, I guess it was, some Hasidic Jews, who were dancing and singing L'chaim to life.
In the camps?
On the way to their executions. And I asked Mr. Wiesel, I said, given what you went through, how are you able to read this? And he said to me very quietly, if they could write it, we must read it. And I can only imagine the heartache that it must have taken for you to write, to put these memoirs down.
It was, but it was in a way a release of having that burden, that pledge finally fulfilled. Because, you know, it's people all around us, those who were dying of typhus and other, the word you always heard, don't forget us. Mm. Tell our story, don't forget us. So it was very important for me to put in a paper. First I thought it would be only for my family, my children, my grandchildren. But as some of my friends read it, they said, well, really, you should publish it. I'm very glad I did it.
And in a very beautiful way, you have fulfilled your promise to your mother with the title and the dedication to her.
Yes, I think so.
Tosha Schneider, thank you very much for going between the lines with us, with your memoir, Someone Must Survive to Tell the World.
Thank you, Lois.
To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, listen to an archived program or browse our suggested reading list for both adults and children. Visit our website at wabe.org/BTL. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to npr.org. Join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go between the lines. The executive producer of this program is Lois Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Editor and technical producer, Mike Johns. Production assistant, Connor Adams. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue. And I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. Between the Lines is a production of WABE Atlanta.